So, just a few days ago, I got back from a long overdue road trip to New Brunswick in Nova Scotia. And on the last day that I was out there, I did something I should have done a long time ago. I went to Piggy's Cove for the first time. David's really pumped about that. Some of you have already been there, I'm sure. But for those of you who, like 6 days ago me, haven't been there, you drive about 30-some kilometers south of Halifax to the mouth of the Margaret Bay, and there's this beautiful, picturesque town perched on the edge. Jutting out from the town is this massive crop of rocks, this cracked and wrinkled rock face that reaches and stretches and touches the Atlantic Ocean. And on top of all that, there's a lighthouse that's like postcard perfect, perched above it all. The day that I went was a weekday. It was the middle of the day, and the place was teeming, just littered with good-for-nothing tourists like me. All of us trying to cram in every summer sight we can into the waning days of August. You know, like 100 upon 100 smartphones just in front of everyone. Just before my friends and I had gone down there, a friend of mine who was in Halifax and had been kind enough to put us up, sat us down and spoke to us in the tones that a parent usually reserves for talking to a kid about a hot stove. And she said, "Keep off the black rocks," which seemed a little intense to me. Sure enough, we got down to Piggy's Cove, and I saw at least two plaques, metal, one bolted onto the beginning point of the rocks, one bolted onto the lighthouse, both of them carrying the very same inscription, and it said this in block letters, "Warning. Injury and death have rewarded careless sightseers here. The ocean and the sea, or the ocean and the rocks, are treacherous. Savor the sea from a distance." Because, some of you may know, the tides come up quickly and imperceptibly, and the winds can whip up rogue waves, and even a small spray of water can slick those rocks black. And every year, actually, people are pulled out, carried out into the open water. And I knew all that. I was standing right beside the sign, looking down over the water. And as the sunlight played on the waves, like the flicker of fire over wood, I just wanted to get closer. So we're walking back to our vehicle, and we pass for the second time one of the oldest churches in Canada, St. John's Anglican Church, perched there in Piggy's Cove. And I couldn't help but wonder as I passed and looked at the open door, what the plaque above that building should read. What words of welcome and warning it should offer for careless sightseers. And what plaque should be above the door that we all came in this morning, alerting us to what might be actually waiting for us here. We might be insensitive to it. Luke, one of the biographers of Jesus, tells us this story, like many stories, about Jesus doing what a good Jew does. He goes to synagogue. We find Jesus going to church this morning. And he shows up in a liturgy that actually would bear remarkable resemblance to what we're up to this morning. And in the middle of all that, Luke says, Jesus spies a woman. And she stands out from the crowd because she cannot stand. She is bent over as if for the last 18 years some invisible hand has pressed all of its weight on her. And Jesus gets her attention and waves her over with a word. And she comes and she hears him say to her, "Woman, be released from your family." He touches her. She stands. She erupts in hallelujahs to high heaven spontaneously. There are several things that we miss about this story, I think, when we do hear it. The first is that this happens in the middle of a sermon. Like right here, imagine right here if in this moment something like that were to happen. I'm not making any offers. But I mean it. Imagine, what might Jesus get up to if he were your preacher this morning? What if Jesus was here? What if he is? What would you and I do when the liturgy veers off course and the leaflet goes out the window and we're all made a little uncomfortable? Well, the presider of the synagogue, the person in the place of Rosh near Stephen, they do the most natural thing, the thing that probably any of us in this room would do. They try to get the train back on the rails, right? Let's get the liturgy back. Let's shut down this sermon. And above all, let's get honoring the Sabbath. Because we, in 21st century, mostly non-Jewish in background, have so little respect for what the Sabbath meant for Israel. I kid you not, if you read the books of Isaiah and Ezekiel, and actually all the prophets of the Hebrew Bible, you will find in nearly every book, at some point, the prophets say the reason that Israel was exiled from their land by God and sent to Babylon was because they failed to honor the Sabbath. Because they refused God's liberating word of rest. God's liberating word that they ought to give their own workers rest. The land rest. They would not live in the rhythm of God. And so this presider of the synagogue is like justifiably nervous about the Sabbath. And what's fascinating is that Jesus does not say, "Tone it down, buddy. The Sabbath is not that important." Jesus takes the high ground, the biblical high ground for this guy. And he says, "Look, you untie your farm animals and release them of their burden so that they can find water and food on the Sabbath. And you should. You should, because the Sabbath is about release. And it always has been. The Sabbath is the day that Israel is asked to remember that they were slaves bent over in Egypt as a force pressed down on their backs. And God brought them out of the wilderness and through the water and to a mountain and gave them the command of Sabbath so that they could stand up straight." So Jesus, as if he has just read Isaiah 58, he knows that "you shall remove the yoke from among you" stands right next to "you must refrain from trampling the Sabbath." These are not two separate things. They are the same thing. Jesus says, your problem is that you're toning it down on the Sabbath. And I want to crank it to 11. And that day, he pushes those presiders, that congregation, everyone present, way out past their comfort zone. Which leads us to another thing that we miss in this passage, which is maybe one of the things that will lead us out of our comfort zone today. It sure does for me. Did you notice these two little moments where Luke tells us why the woman's back is bent? He says it's because a spirit has bent it for 18 years. And it would be nice to be like, to sort of relegate that to Luke's own sort of superstition, someone who lived a long time ago, primitive thinking. Except we'd have to consign Jesus into that category too, wouldn't we? Because when he gets going back and forth with the presider of the synagogue, Jesus says, this woman has been bound for 18 long years by Satan, by a dark, malevolent force, a malignant creature in God's creation that dwells beyond the realm of our five senses, typically. I don't know how you feel about that. But that is not, if I'm honest with you, that's not how I experience the world typically day by day. I fit really neatly inside what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor called the imminent frame. You see, we live in a time and place, a secular age, in which we have worked very hard to attain a degree of mastery and control over our reality. We tend to think that our relationship to ages past is that we have done a process of sober subtraction. We've just, like, gotten rid of all the barnacles of superstition, and now we see things clearly for what they are in the light of God. We can touch, see, taste, smell. Charles Taylor suggests that that's a very flattering story that we tell ourselves. That it's actually our secularity is not what happens when we take away superstition. It's something that we built because it's useful. It's a frame in which we experience. And one of the ways it helps us is by freeing us just beyond the reach of our senses. So Jesus picks up the corner and gives us a cup of prayer. And he'll let it to the Hebrews prison. And it throws the curtain back. Did you notice this? This is, for my money, is one of the craziest passages in the entire New Testament. Speaking to this group of beleaguered host church Christians in Rome, speaking maybe to us, the Church of the Redeemer, the writer of the letter to the Hebrews says, "You have not come to a dark and cloudy and thundering mountain of fire that animals couldn't touch or they would die." He's talking about Mount Sinai, where Israel received the Sabbath, where God showed up overwhelming, and his voice was so thunderous that Israel pleaded with Moses to tell God just to take it easy on him and shut up. And the writer of the Hebrews says, we live after Jesus, so we don't live at Mount Sinai. And we maybe sigh in relief, happy to be welcomed into something more hospitable and manageable, something less overwhelming. And then he says, we're actually at the mountain behind that mountain. Right now, just beyond the range of sight, we are at Mount Zion. And can you hear the choirs and choirs of angels singing? And can you see the bloody priest Jesus, himself a sacrifice for us, welcoming us into his temple? Can you hear the voices of the saints who've gone by who gather around us like a great cloud of witnesses? And can you see our God, the flame in the hearth of this home, the consuming fire, who speaks now and whose voice shakes all that can be shaken in and out of our lives? That's now, says the leader, setting fire to the imminent frame that I rely on for safety and security in my staff. But I rely on for safety and security in the church, for that matter. Because I tend to want this to be more a social choreography of a beautiful symbol that comforts me. And it does. It folds me into a community and a rest. And I'm not always ready to be addressed by the living God. It's a well-known passage by an American writer named Ray Dillon. It's quoted so often that I almost don't want to quote it, but I can't not. In an essay where she weaves together the stories of the many people who went on polar expeditions to the Arctic, often losing their lives when they're praised to get close to the sublime, the wild of the earth. She puts that alongside going to a bumbling Catholic mass for a year. This is what she says. On the whole, Annie Dillard reflects, I do not find Christians outside of the catacombs sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, is no one believing? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill the Sunday morning. It is madness, she says, to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense. Or the waking God may draw us out. What sign should we put above that door? For careless sightseers like me, maybe like you. Warning, maybe. But mine wouldn't end with "Save your fellow distant, stranger." No, no, come closer. Come dangerously close if you dare. To the one who is the consuming fire. Reality presses against the backs of our realities. It calls us beyond the rules that we make for ourselves. Aristotle, an ancient philosopher, said that the virtues are the thing that you find when you go right down the middle. When you split the difference between despair and presumption, you get hope. And one of the things that's fascinating about the Christian story and the Christian God, the Jewish God, is that the call to love is not a virtue of moderation. You cannot love in moderation. So to be here, if indeed Jesus is Lord, if indeed Jesus is not alone, we must not love in moderation. We must let the weeping God call us out to our weeping every time. We must not love God with half our heart and with our whole heart. We must not keep just enough Sabbath that we do the appropriate self-care that gives us rest and fail to untie the burdens of our brothers and sisters and siblings who are under a heavy load in body or in soul or under the systems that we have made. We must not love our neighbor with